But welcome to New Hope. We did start a 13-week series last week called Long Story Short. Before we get into it, I did want to just address the elephant in the room, right? It's game day. It's Super Bowl. You got places to be. You got recipes that are probably already in the oven. But I got a text from one of my very best friends this morning, and I thought it would just kind of help laser focus on just this morning, just for a little bit. It says, you should be as excited about church as about the Super Bowl. So when your pastor makes a point this Sunday, pour Gatorade over his head. My first thought was, glad I'm not your pastor. And my second thought was, why only Super Bowl Sunday? And Pastor Matt looks great in red. So it can be an every week thing. I do suggest the lower sugar for his sake. It'll probably be less sticky. So we'll just we'll leave that up here for next week. My name is Dave Gray. I'm one of the elders here, and I will be preaching. As many of you know, Pastor Matt is out of town. He's getting his mother moved down to her kind of winter home in Florida. And it occurred to me this morning, somehow he ended up in Florida on Super Bowl Sunday, and I'm preaching. But we'll talk to him about that when he gets back. So last week we started Long Story Short, and it is a comprehensive attempt to take the Bible from cover to cover in 13 weeks. Not off to a great start. I think last week we got past the first five words. In the beginning, God created. Yeah, that's five words. So we're going to have to pick up the tempo. No, we got a little bit farther. So the main thread that we're going to be tugging at throughout this whole series is just the character of God. And one of the things we talked about last week is how we trust kind of without even knowing it, we trust God with the biggest aspects of our life. If we believe that in the beginning God created, right, then it is He that is keeping us on a planet that is rotating over 1,000 miles an hour, and we can't feel it, and we don't fly off into outer space. It is He that breathed out a universe, an ever-expanding, massive universe, and it is He that continues to hold it together. So we inherently believe these things by faith without even really recognizing, kind of by taking for granted. And then we struggle to trust Him with the smaller things, right? We know that deep down, we have confidence in God and the big things. Deep down, we believe that that God is bigger than big. That was a term that kind of laid out as part of the series last week. And I'll be honest, I kind of struggled with how elementary that was. But as I thought about how the fact that I'd never thought about the fact that God is keeping this universe and this planet together because I took it for granted, maybe an elementary term makes sense. So God is bigger than big. The theological word for that we discussed last year was transcendent. Our God is transcendent. We also talked about how God is closer than close. Another elementary term to just remind us continuously that God always takes the first step towards mankind. He has always taken the first step. He will always take the first step. After creation, Adam and Eve sin, right? They do the one thing that God tells them not to do. And all of creation falls as a result to it. And while Adam and Eve hide in the garden, trying to distance themselves from God's presence, God comes to the garden and says, Adam, where are you? And then God takes the animal that will be the first killing of any creature in all of history, and God Himself sheds that blood to atone for their sins and to use those skins to cover their nakedness and their shame. God Himself that separates Adam and Eve from the tree of life. Ironically, a tree that they had permission to eat out of, and hadn't found it yet. But He separates them from the tree of life because it wasn't part of God's story for them to be stuck in that fallen state forever. So Adam and Eve are removed from the garden, and the tree of life is hidden away by God and protected by God because that wasn't His plan for mankind. God always takes the first step towards us. Today we're going to talk about the second inciting incident, the promise. That's closer than I thought it was. We're going to take a look at Genesis 12, 1 through 3. Genesis 12, 1 through 3 says, Now the Lord said to Abram, Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those that bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all of the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abram went as the Lord had told him. And Lot went with him, Lot's his nephew. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed for Haran. So God starts off in verse 1 by making a command. says, Abraham, I want you to leave your land. I want you to leave your people. I want you to leave your future. And I want you to go somewhere. He doesn't even tell him where they're going. He says, go to a land that I will show you. And if you do that, if you leave, if you go somewhere blindly, without even knowing where you're going, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. I will bless those that bless you, and I will curse those that curse you. Now, a few things that we know about Abram and his wife is Sarai. And I'm using the words Abram and Sarai because at the beginning of the story, that's their name. We know them more commonly as Abraham and Sarah. But there's a very, very important shift that happens in the story when they become Abraham and Sarah. And so I want to make that distinction real because it's in here for a reason. So one of the things that we know about Abram, we know that he's old, right? We know that he's 75. In chapter 11, we find out he's from a region called the Ur of Chaldees. And the Ur of Chaldees was a very pagan people. It was a pagan land. They were idol worshippers, primarily the moon. They were primarily moon worshippers. So Abram would have likely worshipped the moon and or any other number of family deities that were part of their tradition. One of the important things and interesting things is there's not one mention of Abram's character or faith. And that is a common thread. Like if you think about Noah and the faith he had, and he was saved because of the faith he had. And most, if not all of the other characters of the Bible were chosen by God because of their character and their faith. It doesn't seem to be true in this case. God simply says, you're my guy. And whether you believe the Bible or not, whether you're sure about Christianity or the church, what I would point to is one thing is the historical importance of what unfolds in this story. Because the three great global religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Muslim religions, all point towards this moment in this man. All three of those religions say, this is our guy. Abraham is our guy. So for no other reason than the historical value, I encourage you to just kind of dial in to what happens next. Verse 4. It says, so Abraham went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abraham was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. I forgot Sarai. So that's Abram. What we know about Sarai, she was barren and she was beautiful, which is ironic considering Abram means exalted father. So Abram's name means exalted father, yet he has a wife that cannot bear him children. We know that she was barren because the Bible tells us. We know that she was beautiful because even in her very old age, Sarai was still sought by kings to be part of their harems. So she was barren, which would have been a disgrace. It would have been shameful. The number one responsibility in that era and those people was for her to provide an heir, which she could not do. So we know of and Sarai's name means my princess or like little princess. It seems like a term of endearment from a dad calling his little girl my little princess or my princess. So we know what their names used to mean. And then verse 4. So Abram went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So Abram and Sarai obey. They obey a God. They obey a God that they have never met. And they leave everything behind without directions, a compass, or a map. God simply says, I will lead you. And they leave. Now we know now that the land that they were moving into was the land of Canaan. Canaan was about a 400-mile journey from where they started in the Ur of Chaldees. And I got to think that perhaps it was a little bit of a mercy that they didn't have kids yet. Can you imagine traveling that far with kids on a camel? You know how are we there yet? Is that? And the worst part about are we there yet, you don't even know, right? Abraham doesn't even know when he's getting where he's getting. And yet, they're making this crazy long journey. And then in chapter 12, verses 7 through 9, it says, then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he moved to the hill country in the east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the east and Ai on with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed on, still going toward the Negev. And I like this picture because, you know, first of all, they're traveling, don't know where going. God says, stop. You're here. Like, you've made it. Everything that you see, I will be given to your people and to your ancestry. It kind of recalls that moment in The Lion King, right? When Mufasa takes little Simba up on top of that hill. And he says, everything the light touches will be yours. But I love Abram's response to this, because they don't set up camp. It says they journeyed on into that promised land. They weren't going to set up on the edge and kind of they were moving into that land of promise. They were possessing that land that God had given, and they move in to that land of promise. And then it pretty much goes downhill from there. This is a story, just a constant reminder for me on how God can use a total screw-up like me, because Abram and Sarah make some bad decisions. In fact, they make almost nothing but bad decisions. Now, we don't know much about the time frame. We know that from the time the promise was made that he would have an heir until the promise is fulfilled is 25 years. We're given little earmarks along the way, but for the most part, we don't know. And by the end of chapter 12, maybe it's a year, maybe it's 5 years, maybe it's 10 years. But by the end of that same exact chapter, we're going to see a crack in Abram's resolve. We're going to see a crack in his faith. We're going to see the first compromise. In 12 verse 10, it says there was a great famine in the land. And rather than staying in that land that the God had given them to possess and said that he would provide and protect them for, he said, nope, God, I think I have to take care of this one on my own. We're going to go to Egypt, where the famine had not struck. So he leaves the land of promise, lacking faith in God's provision, and he goes into Egypt. And immediately following that, he shows lack in God's protection. He displays very clearly that he is more scared of man than he is of God. Because when they get to the outskirts of Egypt, he turns to Sarai and he says, Sarai, we got to get on the same page. We're gonna have to lie. Because if we enter Egypt, you're so pretty. And I don't even know what that means. Like, how beautiful do you have to be to know that just by entering a nation, like, they're going to want to take your wife? But she was that pretty, right? So they're getting ready to enter Egypt. And he turns and he says, you're going to have to lie. We're going to have to say that you're my sister, not my wife. Because as my wife, they're going to kill me and take you. As my sister, they'll just take you and they'll let me live. Great guy, right? Awesome. And not only did they take Sarai and let Abram live, but then Pharaoh paid him a whole bunch of stuff for his sister. Now, we find out later in the book, it actually was a half-truth. They shared a mother and had different fathers, which was not uncommon in that day. So Abram and Sarai were actually half-siblings. So he gives up this wife of promise. But God is not going to be up for that, right? He's going to stand on that promise that he made. And immediately, Pharaoh's house is afflicted and his lands are afflicted. So suddenly and so severely that Pharaoh actually puts it together that the moment this all happened was when I took her into my harem. And then it is revealed that she is actually his wife, not his sister. And Pharaoh actually goes to Abram and scolds him and says, why would you do that? Like, what? Look at the trouble that you brought for my family. You said that she was your sister. Why didn't you tell me she's your wife? I want you to take Sarai. I want you to take all the stuff we gave you. I want you to take all your stuff and leave. He kicks him out of Egypt because he's more scared of God than Abram was. Like, something happened. He's like, I need these people out of my land. So God preserves his promise. Despite all of that, despite those just lacks of faith, Genesis 15, 1 through 6, God is doubling down on his promise. He's like, there's nothing you can do to mess this up, Abram and Sarah. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. And Abram said, behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, look towards heaven and number the stars. If you're able to number them, then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. See, there's a thing about promises. promises are only as good as the character of the promise maker. Whoever here has ever made a promise and broken it. Come on, right? Who here has ever had a promise broken to you? Yeah, right? Every single hand. God doesn't make promises like that. When God says something's going to happen, there's nothing that we can do to mess it up. And so God's character is coming out in this, and no matter how poorly they behaved, and no matter how poor their decisions were, you can trust on the character of the promise maker when it is made by a God that is bigger than good, bigger than big, and wants to be closer than close. So God in chapter 15 doubles down on that promise, and he takes him outside, and he shows him the stars. And yet, chapter 16, they lack faith, not in just protection or provision, but in the actual promise itself. In chapter 16, we see rolled out the story of Sarai and Hagar, where they're just kind of, they're giving up. They're like, you know what, I think God needs help. I don't think he can, like he has all the tools to make this promise come true. Or maybe we just didn't understand God. So Sarai says, I want you to take my handmaiden. We're getting really old. Like, the ability for us to have children is already kind of impossible. Why don't you take my handmaiden, Hagar, and have an heir with him, with her? And so that's what they do. And we have born Ishmael, an illegitimate son of promise, because they tried to force God's hand. They tried to cheat the promise into existence. And you want to talk about horribly wrong? I mean, we're talking about the birth of generational conflict with the Muslim nations and Judaism that exists today was the outcome of this lack of faith. Didn't matter. God was going to fulfill his promise anyway. Chapter 17, 4. Behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude. Father of a multitude of nations. So God renews the promise, and then something really interesting happens, because this is where the name change happens. He looks at Abram, he says, your name is not Abram anymore, it's Abraham. Remember at the beginning we said Abram means exalted father? Abraham means the father of a multitude, literally. So he changes his name. Now, you're not just a great father, you're not just a good father, you're the father. You're going to be the father of my nation. And he turns to Sarai and he says, your name's not Sarai anymore, it's Sarah. You're nobody's little princess. Sarah means princess, as in the princess, as in the princess of God's nation. So he promises again in 17:4. He changes their name to just make it impactful. And then God goes a step farther. In chapter 17, verse 21, he says, but I will establish my covenant with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you this time next year. This time next year. Not conceived, bear. Which means they are in a 3-month window until conception. And this is the part of the story that makes me feel really good about myself. Because what happens next is unconceivable. Because despite this promise, despite being given a very clear timeline that they will be able to confirm in 3 or 4 months, he gives her away again. They cross into the land of Abimelech, and Abimelech the king has heard of her beauty. What that being that beautiful at 80, 90 years old means, I don't even get that. Like, how does that even, but it's true, and he takes her because they lie again, and they say that she's his sister instead of his wife. So again, he demonstrates he's more fearful of man than he is of God. And not only that, but they're totally turning their back on the promise. Like, he's given her up. She's gone. They only had a 3-month wait. I don't know where they are in that 3-month wait, but it's only a 3-month wait. Like, if that's me, I'm hiding under a rock for 3 months. Like, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not crossing any weird foreign territories where they might take my wife. Like, what is going on? Regardless. No matter how dumb we are, no matter how poor of a decision we make, God is going to come through. Chapter 21, verses 1 through 3. The Lord visited Sarah, as he had said, And the Lord did to Sarah as he had promised. And Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the time of which God had spoken to him. Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore him, Isaac. See, Abimelech took Sarah to be in his harem. And what took probably several days to mess up, God straightened out with one vision. The Bible says that he came to Abimelech in a vision and said, "You're a dead man, because that is Abraham's wife." And Abimelech said, "Whoa, he said it was his sister. He can have her back." Like, so in what they messed up in a couple of verses, God straightened out with one vision. And so he gets his wife back, and the fulfillment of the promise is on us. In verse 1 through 3 of 21, Isaac is born. Now we know that at this point, Abraham is 100 years old, and this promise has been fulfilled. Now we're not sure how much time passes between chapter 21 and chapter 22, but a lot of scholars and theologians put it at around 20 to 30 years. I know in kind of our Western Christianity minds, Isaac was like this scrawny little 13-year-old kid. We know that that wasn't the case. In fact, Josephus said he could have been as old, which is a first century historian, said he could have been as old as 37 by the time chapter 22 happens. But chapter 22 rolls around, and God needs to know if Abraham is ready to lead his nation. God needs to know if he's going to fear man more than he's going to fear God. He needs to know whether he's going to trust God's provision instead of trying to do it on his own. And most importantly, he needs to know that Abraham is going to honor the giver more than the gift. He's going to honor the promiser more than he honored the promise. And so verse 1, 22, verse 1 through 4. 1 through 3. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham," and he said, "Here am I." I want to stop there for a moment because that's not a simple, "Hey God, I'm over here. You know, I'm right here. I heard my name." This "here am I," it's why it's exclamation point and in parentheses. When you see that in the Bible, that is a statement of resolve in the affirmative without knowing what they're being asked. That's not, "Hey, I'm over here." That's yes. I don't know what the request or question is, but yes. Like, I'm saying yes before I know what the request is. It's Abraham saying, "I am not screwing up anymore. I am not going to be more scared of man. I'm not going to distrust his provision or his protection anymore. Whatever you say, you got it." So here am I. He said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love," foreshadowing much, "take your son, your only son, whom you love, and I want you to go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac, and he cut the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Now, a couple of things I want to pull out of here, because I think it's really important, and I think it's more important as the story goes along, is the region of Moriah would be eventually where the Temple Mount was set up. On the highest peak in the land of Moriah is where the Temple Mount would be. Somewhere outside of that temple, not far away, on a smooth, round-topped hill called Golgotha, is where the ultimate sacrifice would one day atone for all of our sins. God has called them to hallowed ground. This is a spot, not just a happening, that is going to echo through eternity. Furthermore, he takes two young men with him. Now, we know some more at this point about Abraham. He was a wealthy guy. So wealthy, in fact, that he and his nephew had grown so much in their estates, and they had so many cattle, and they had so many sheep, that they couldn't coexist in the same region. Because the shepherds are bickering over pastures, and the cattlemen are arguing over land, and they just can't coexist. And Abraham says, "Listen, it's not worth our relationship. Grass is not worth our relationship. Lot, you pick a direction. Whatever direction you go, and I'll pick another direction, and I'll go that way." And now years and years have passed. So he is a wealthy man. He is a renowned man of his time. And this was a dangerous time. You did not hop on a horse with two young servants and head on a multiple-day journey across the wilderness unless you were suicidal. It was a very dangerous time to travel. especially if you were an affluent individual that would have been well known through the land. But he shows faith in God's protection. So I don't need my bodyguard. I'm not going to bring 30 guys. We need a couple of servants to help build a fire and cook food. That's what we're going to bring. Because I'm not counting on myself or my men to keep me safe. If God has told me to do this thing, then that's all the protection that I need. And then 4-9. It says, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over and worship and come again to you. Great example of English not always getting the full picture in its translation. And some of your translations actually probably have it correctly. There should be another we in there. Because in the Hebrew, when Abraham makes this declaration to the servants, it is that he and his son are going to make offerings, and he and his son are going to return. Like we see in here, Abraham, and we'll get there, there's some ideas of why, but Abraham has 100% obedient. Like he is going to do exactly what God says, and 100% faith in the promise. Say, like, I know I'm going over there to sacrifice my son. I also know that you've promised to make him a nation, so obviously he's coming back. Most historians believe that he truly believed that he was going to follow through with that sacrifice and God was going to raise Isaac from the dead. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. This is another reason that we know he's not a scrawny little 13-year-old. If you picture the amount of wood it would take to consume a human-sized sacrifice, like that's a lot of wood to carry up a mountain, and it says he laid it on Isaac's back. So we don't know if he's a middle-aged man or a young man, but this is a man. This is not a kid that's carrying a couple hundred pounds of wood up a mountain. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife, so they went both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. He said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they went both of them together. We see Abraham trusting God's provision. He's like, I don't know. I don't know where it's going to come from, but it's going to be there. I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know how God's going to do it, but I don't need to. I'm just going to be obedient. I'm going to do exactly what he told me to do and trust that I can trust his protection and trust that I can trust his provision. Verse 9 through 14. When they came to the place of which God had told them, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. That's a trusting son. And he took, Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, saying, Abraham, Abraham! He said, here am I. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. Now, I know there's some things that we won't know until we get to the other side of glory. But I think I've gotten kind of an idea how God works. I don't think that was just the region that would end up being Golgotha. I think that was the spot. I think in that very spot, 2,000 years later, God took that knife out of Abraham's hand and used it to slaughter his own son on the cross. The ultimate promise keeper from the one, the only one that can make a promise that big is a God that big, a God that is transcendent. We see Abraham respond. He says, I'm not gonna be scared of man anymore. I'm not gonna be scared of my needs anymore. I'm not going to think for once that God can't fulfill his promise, whether it blows my mind or not, whether I can understand how it's going to work or not. This was a tough one. It's hard to spend that much time kind of thinking those points without it becoming introspective, which is very uncomfortable. And I just started asking myself the question, how am I fearing man more than I fear God? You know, where in my life am I lacking that faith in his protection? What about his provision? That was a tough one, because there's a lot of areas in my life as I kind of dismantled things that I'm working way harder to do it my own way than to rest and to wait. What promises have I taken for granted? If I can take for granted the fact that I'm standing here on a planet that's moving over 1,000 miles an hour and we don't even know it, what else am I taking for granted? As you go out today, church, I would encourage you to just wrestle with those things. Dig down and think about those areas in which we compromise. We all compromise. Part of the reason I love the fact that God uses broken, sinful people that make terrible decisions is because I'm a broken, sinful person that makes terrible decisions. And it's just a constant reminder that God is not looking for perfect people. There aren't any. God is not looking for extraordinary people. You think God needs somebody to be extraordinary? You think there's anything that anybody has ever been able to do, except for Jesus, that can offer anything to God? A God that is bigger than big and wants to be closer to close, closer than close? God fulfills his promises. He fulfilled the ultimate promise on the cross, and there's nothing that we can do to undermine it.